problem we dealt with last week, and I don't want to minimize the problem, was the Rav modern Orthodox in the sense that the term is used today? It may very well be, make it a drop louder, it may very well be that the Rav could live in two worlds. And what I said last week, there was one point in the shiur when I re-listened to the tape, I just want to call your attention because I think it's a fabulous thought. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman and Rabbi Avram Yitzchak Cohen Cook could grow up in the same yeshiva. That could not happen today. And the Rav could combine two worlds and live in two worlds. And I think my description of the Rav as being classic Orthodox, if I can use that term, brisk v'lashon, and yet he was totally part of the Western world. There was no synthesis. The Rav said that in his own language. I reconstructed years ago the 1956 talk he gave to the rabbinic alumni, and at that talk, the Rav said, I don't believe in synthesis. He said, synthesis does not create his thrust was that when you have synthesis, you have to compromise at either end. And the Rav spoke in more in terms of harmonious coexistence, or what he described as having two heads. He said, people say I have two heads, we wear two hats. He said, better two heads than none. And it was a sharp thought, as the Rav was capable of, but I think that's an apt description of the Rav. I thought about something else after Shia, and something you can play with. Look, there are two Talmidim from the Rav's last period of active teaching and powerful teaching. One is Reb Chaim Milson, whom you all know. And there's another Talmud who teaches at Bar Ilan, who goes around quoting the Rav, claims he's a Talmud Mufak, someone, Rabbi Dr. Jeffrey Wolf, if you recognize the name. And I thought to myself, who would the Rav be more comfortable with? Reb Chaim Milson or Rabbi Dr. Jeffrey Wolf? And if you know Wolf, that's the Round Table Forum, Modern Orthodoxy, the whole thrust, a certain dislike of the Haredi world, etc. I don't think he's a member of Reda, but on the borderline, very close. And I've heard, Dr. Wolf is one of the few people I went to hear speak, because simply I was curious, Mativo Shalubaze. And you know something? The more I thought about it, the more I concluded, the Rav, in my opinion, would be more at home with Reb Chaim Milson. And I have no doubt that I'm absolutely correct in this assumption. The Rav would be more at home with Reb Chaim Milson than with Rabbi Dr. Jeffrey Wolf. And you see, that says something. And I'll say something else, and Yitzchak alluded to it at the end of the shiur, but we didn't carry it out properly. If you want to see the Rav court between two worlds, where it becomes more and more difficult to breach the two worlds, you take the issue of the women's prayer groups. Remember, the Rav was still functioning. It was the early 80s, albeit he was not in perfect health and his mind was not perfect at all times. And there's no question that I often say that after 1979, you cannot give the same shtanz or the same authority, ototokef, to what the Rav said, because by 1980 on, he suffered many strokes, his health and his mind, there was a downhill slide. Anyone who's heard tapes of the Rav knows that through 79 it was on one level, and after 79 it's not the same. I can tell you actually a fact from over here that we had a chaver in our days in YU. One of the top students was a fellow named Freddie Hurwitz, Ephraim Hurwitz from Far Rockaway. And he was very close to the Rav, Mamasha Ben Torah 100%. And Freddie Hurwitz, a little older than I am, Freddie Hurwitz came in Aliyah, I think even a year or two before I did. And he had a son, Merkaz HaRav, tough quality. And I remember the early 80s, he asked Baruch Lichtenstein, he wants to send his son to YU to learn with the Rav. It's a schut, I understand. I think every normal Ben Torah dreams of having the schut that his son should learn with the same Rebbe that inspired him. And I remember Abaron said to him, there's nothing to go for now. It's not the same. Things have changed. It's a downhill slide. So with this in mind, that you can't give the same credence to the Rav in the 80s as the Rav before the 1980s. Please close the door. Before the 1980s, nevertheless, you take the woman's prayer group issue and you see the Rav struggling. And what do I mean by that? There were those that came out and matter and encouraged it, and 100%. There were Rosh Yeshiva, on the other hand, who ushered it 100%. The same Rosh Yeshiva asked the Rav to sign the Issa. Remember, Rav Shachter wrote the tshuva, Rav Heschel wrote the tshuva, Morty Willick signed, Teddy Panner signed, Abba Brandspiegel signed. Did anyone else sign? You can correct me if I'm leaving out a name, perhaps Aaron Khan. I think there were five signatures, Pesach HaKol. The Rav refused to sign. See, and that's fascinating. Now, I established beyond any question of a doubt, because I asked, not depending upon the articles and tradition, each article contradicts the other article, but I checked it out with the Rav's Gaboyim. Among them were his closest Gaboyim, Kenny Brandon, Neil Turk, and these were people who I myself, there were my own Talmidim, Neil Turk, there was at this point already Barry Holzer. These are people I knew intimately. Kenny Brander was not my student, but his brother was my student, his sister-in-law was my student, his father was a chaver of mine in yeshiva. So these people I trust intimately. And they told me the Rev refused to sign. And the reason he said, it's halachically I'm not opposed. Halachically he said you can't usher it. Politically, I find it difficult. And that's a very revealing statement, because what is the Rav saying in reality? That he recognizes, halachically, perhaps there's nothing we can say if women want to go into a room and daven and don't say Kedush and don't say Baruch Hu, and don't say Kaddish. How can you say an Issa to it? On the other hand, the Rav sense that the political implications are you're developing a new breed of orthodoxy, a new breed of Shmirat Torah Mitzvot. And the implications were that ultimately it would lead Torah into endless compromise. And that was a very interesting comment, that politically he opposed it, halachically he said it was wrong. And he said he didn't want to sign because Reb Heschel's tshuva opposed it halachically. If you recall the tshuva, he makes out of it the fact that then Mavatel Tzila B'tziba, but look, plain simple lumdus tells you that levatel tefillah betzibah for a woman's not mechuyevet in tefillah betzibah. So halachically, these are weak complaints, and the Rav refused to sign. Now look back, had the Rav signed that Issa, it would have been a different ballpark. In other words, with all due respects to my dear chaverim and colleagues, Gedolei Yisrael, but with all due respects to Rav Heschel Shechter, Rav Mordechai Willig, Rav Yehuda Panis, Rav Avraham Brandspiegel, etc., lacking the Rav's signature, that document did not have the same authority. And that's just catching the Rav. He's caught. I can understand that he's struggling. It's an issue that tears at the heart. He's educated women. He's taught them Gemara. He's the first one in America to teach them Gemara. And now they want to go a step further. And they want to dominate. They want to have a feeling of Tfilah B'Tzibur. And yet, this is the fallout of feminism and all that's happening in America and the conservative movement and female rabbis and female cantors and women who can give aid to it. And there's one responsum after another being written by the Seminary Commission on Jewish Law. It's worth looking at them. Joe Roth, etc. And the Rav says, politically, I'm opposed, you see. And this would indicate, among other many indications, that it's an apt description of the Rav. He was a brisky, he was a lushan, he walked in the modern world nimbly and with ease. But to call him modern orthodox in that sense that we use it today, I don't think it's fair, because the Rav's orthodoxy had no modernity to it. It was conservative with a small c, and he could bridge the two worlds. Problem comes afterwards. The next generation finds it very difficult. And I have no doubt in my mind that when Rabbi Lamb coined the phrase centrist orthodoxy, the Rav would not have been happy with that. Because centrist orthodoxy is, once again, it's defining your orthodoxy. The Rav would not have been happy. On the other hand, Rabbi Lamb already is a generation removed, and a generation removed, and two generations removed, and as we see happening now, people are taking sides. Either you're totally Torah modern in the full sense of the word, or you're coming back to the Haredi world and going back to your roots. Anyway, It's an interesting question. I don't say I've solved the problem and I leave it to future researchers. I don't think it can be solved black and white, but this is the way I understood the Rav, watching him, breathing with him, listening to tapes throughout the years, being an intimate friend with those that were his intimate disciples, and this is the way I understood the Rav. I would love for Rabbi Manny Holzer to hear the lecture I gave last week, and I would value his opinion, because Eitan's grandfather, I don't think there was anyone closer to the Rav. Once Rabbi Klavan died, and Rabbi Klavan died about 1980, I don't think there was anyone closer to the Rav. Manny Holzer was close to the Rav, certainly the 50s into the 60s, the 70s and the 80s, but there was no one closer to the Rav in the last decade or so of his life. And I'd be curious to see Manny's reaction, because he knew the Rav intimately. Yes, yes. What do you want to say? Right. We don't really know the Rambam. The Rav used to say, were you there when Rav Nissim came to America? I don't think you were there. I was a Rosh Yeshiva already. So you made a reception for Rav Nissim. And the Rav spoke beautiful. We didn't know the Rav knew beautiful Latin Hebrew. We were flabbergasted, you understand? The whole faculty was there, Dr. Belkin. And the Rav gets up and says in beautiful Latin Hebrew, all my life I've wondered what the Rambam looked like. And now that I see Rav Yitzchak Nissim, I understand what the Rambam looked like. It was a mag. And Rav Nissim got up and said, you don't have to wonder anymore. Come to Israel. You know, this was a great Zionist. Come to Israel and you'll see many people who knew what the Rambam looked like. You know, and everyone was laughing. It was a good exchange between them. But I don't know. Look, your question is fascinating. I can only tell you, I believe the Rav would be more comfortable with Chaim Milson. I saw the Rav with Chaim Milson. I know the way the Rav related to Yitz Greenberg and others of that ilk. And I know, again, I know the Rav's children. I mean, after all, I cannot imagine that Atara and Tova turned out what they are without influence from their father. And there's no doubt in my mind that their answer would be, with all their problems with Chaim Milson, don't think everyone falls calling for him. He's misread the Rav and misjudged the Rav and misquoted the Rav. Fine, he's a product of the 70s. He's a product of art scroll and the swing to the right. But with all that criticism, the Rav would be more comfortable. I can only tell you, I've told the story many times. 1978, it was a wonderful Shabbos. The Rav was still top form mentally. Physically already there was a downfall, but still not what happens after 1980. So I spend Shabbat with the Rav in Boston, okay? And it was very fascinating. Now, I come back to his house, 10 Hancock Road, which you probably know where it is, Yitzchak, and he's surrounded now by students who have come to spend Shabbos with him. Literally, students are with him day and night. Chaim Milson was there, others were there, some of them were my own Talmidim, including Chaim Milson. So the Rav, and this is after spending a whole Shabbos with him. I was talking with him and learning Friday night, talking and learning on Shabbos morning, and now I'm back again Shabbos afternoon. And this is the first time I see the Rav with other students. You follow me? Until then, I saw the Rav in Mamali, I saw the Rav in Shul, I saw the Rabbi. We were alone. I was alone with the Rav. But now, these other students are there, and the Rav calls me aside, and he whispers in my ear, he says, these are my Talmud. They says they know how to learn. They're lamdonim. They have mysterious nefesh v'teira, but don't listen to their hashkafas. They're crazy. He says they're anti-Zionist. They're anti-secular study. So I thought the Rav was playing to me. You know, in other words, the Rav knew I'm Aaron Catholic, knew where I'm coming from. So he wants to make me feel good. You understand? I found out Aaron Batten back to see the Rav a year or two later. The Rav told him exactly the same thing. Eric Zimmer went back to see the Rav. The Rav calls him aside, told him exactly the same thing. So, but with all that being said, the Rav was totally at home with these fellas. In other words, he understood, and I have it in my book too, that my Talmidim are firmer than me, my Talmidim are this, my Talmidim are that. But he was totally at home with them. But I don't know. This is the way I saw the Rav. This is the way I understood the Rav. And this is my reaction. And I recognize, and this is why there's so much difference of opinion who the Rav was, because he could bridge both generations. My example, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, I mean, it's a very powerful example. Think for a moment what I said. This is a historic fact. Rabbi Chanan was opposed to publishing a 50th anniversary volume of Chiddushei Torah in honor of Rabbi Shimon Shkop to raise money for the Gretna Yeshiva, because Rabbi Chanan said, we never heard of publishing Sefer Yodlot before. It's unbelievable how conservative he was with a small C. And the same bench was sitting Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook, who was the most innovative thinker of the first half of the 20th century. So they could do it. But now, 30, 40 years later, everyone stands up and is counted. So you have the people who are saying the Rav, Kulo Torah. You have the people who are saying, no, it's a different world, a different orthodoxy. We're centrist, we're modern. A girl told me proudly yesterday, I'm modern orthodox. And I think that the students, I don't know how happy they are with me in the dress yet. I said to them, what do you mean by you're modern orthodox? If you tell me it means you don't have to cover your hair when you get married, you're putting a knife in my back. I don't think they wanted to hear that. They really think modern orthodox, you don't have to cover your hair, you can do this, you can do that. You understand that? They have a concept of modern orthodox, you don't have to be so frum anymore. And this is the big conflict we have today. How do we create a modern orthodoxy that's like the Rav's modern orthodoxy? Can we do it? Can we create it? Okay. Anyway, the issue hangs fire. It's never going to be resolved because the Rav had both elements in him. And I think Yitzchak said it best. We don't deny the fact that he was halachically brisk, falushin, conservative, small c. On the other hand, you can't deny the fact he lived in the big world. And if he told students, choose Harvard over Bernard Revel Graduate School, if he told the student, choose Harvard over Lakewood, it's not that they necessarily listened to him, but it reflects a certain thinking. It wasn't that the Rav was opposed to learning, but the Rav felt you needed panasa, you needed to make a living, and you the better degree, the better the college, the better university. And remember, he created a whole world of... I remember when Rav Avadya Yosef went to America the first time in the early 70s, there's a picture in my book with an exact date of where he meets the Rav. And I remember when Rav Avadya came back, he was overwhelmed. He met doctors and lawyers and professors, and they all learned Shas and Poskim, Talmidim of the Rav. In that respect, the Rav absolutely succeeded. Where do we go from here? All right, that's the next generation, Dor Dor V'Dosho. But I think it's a fair description. Let me just say one other thing on last week's class, then I want to move further. Yes, the Rav felt very bad that he didn't succeed in giving his Talmidim a motion. In the talk, and Yitz, I brought you my tape. Give it. This is Rabbi Lichtenstein. I'm lending it to you. I want it back because I want to hear it again. I want to see if there's anything I don't know again. I want to listen carefully. But it's powerful. Anyway, that tape, Rabbi Lichtenstein, my first listening to it, there's nothing on it that I didn't know myself. But I want to listen again because I want to see one midrash that Rav misquoted, he corrects him. I want to hear it again. It's fascinating to me because I see the same problems I have with the Rav, that he would quote Midrashim Baal Peh and he would change the Lashon. Rabbi Lichtenstein has it exactly on the tape. So Rabbi 2 makes the point that the Rav totally always complained about the Talmidim who took the Torah didn't take the emotion, the clippings of modern orthodoxy. He said, I failed as a saint teacher. I succeeded as a king teacher. I failed as a saint teacher. And see, this too I find very fascinating. When the Rav was about to be published, I naively thought, wow, my work, what are they going to criticize? I say in advance, I'm limiting myself to one aspect of the Rav. Read my introduction. I didn't want to make the mistake I told you that Rav Heschel made. Heschel was too much, and they clipped his wings because they said, here, this is Hashkafa, you don't have enough, you don't have this, you don't have that, the Chiddush Torah in the back on the Parshat Shavua, you're missing this, you're missing that, and he was quite criticized. So I thought, I'm limiting myself to one area of the Rav, and look what I've done, I've reconstructed the Rav's spiritual autobiography in his own words. It's primary. Two-thirds of the work is primary. It's tapes. It's the Rav speaking. I said, the only possible criticism can be that maybe I edited the tapes or I selected, and anyone who go into it will see there was no editing, no selection. It was Mamish the Rav, Pshuto Kamashmo. And then I found, yes, there were those that appreciated beautiful reviews, and then there was one review that was just unbelievably bitter and filled with hatred, literally hatred. And it's the only review that appeared in Israel in the Jerusalem Report. that I'm a disgrace to modern orthodoxy, I disgrace the Rav's modern orthodoxy, all modern orthodoxy can do is tell stories. And then I realized as time marched on, very fascinating, that those that have the emotion and have a little bit of the saint teacher in them or the saint student, they love the work. Those that lack that emotion, they're upset. It's like I did something wrong by describing the Rav on his emotional aspect. See, that aspect of the Rav they never saw, and it's fascinating. And many of those people are the ones that are the leaders of so-called modern orthodoxy today. They're the ones that are very innovative. In New Jersey, Rabbi Yosef Adler took that review that Sokolov signed. I don't believe he wrote it. I believe it was ghostwritten. I believe someone else wrote the heart of it. Because that English there, it's only one person in the world who could write that English. But Rabbi Yosef Adler took the review and sent it around and signed underneath, "I agree." And I'm excited. Rabbi Yosef Adler, women's prayer groups, he made some, the Rav would alive today, he would permit this, permit that, etc. So I found very interesting, I may be wrong, but I find a correlation here, that where you're filled with the saint teacher as well as the king teacher, you love the work. Where you are filled with the king teacher, but the saint teacher never spoke to you. It never reached you. Either the Rav never appeared that way to you, you didn't see him in that light, could be. Or simply you were not primed to accept that type of the Rav. Your whole gestalt simply had no room for it because of your personal disposition. So their mom is not just unhappy with the work, they're mad at me. And that's what I told you. The joker is, I say to Rabbi, Rabbi tells me, I loved your work. So instead of telling me he loved it because I said this, I said that, I called this, I called that, he says, "I love your work." He says, "Professor Sokolov is going around saying you made the Rav into a Rosh Yeshiva." You follow me? So he loves it, because if he says, "I made the Rav into a Rosh Yeshiva," and he's criticizing it, then Rabbi loves it. But you see, it's that same conflict again. Because Abba certainly took from the Rav the king teacher and the saint teacher. Sokolov, I don't know, but I gather from others that the saint teacher is slightly lacking there. It's more the king, the mind, the intellect, modern orthodoxy. So it's interesting. You see that same dichotomy again. And yet, slachis echais, you know, sometimes you feel bad when someone hits you over the head. It's natural. You knock that on the floor, you feel a little bad. But Baruch Hashem, now I'm back in the batter's box and I can handle it. Okay, now, that's modern orthodoxy. Now let me move further. And I want to deal with something else that becomes very important. And again, it's not spelled out. I have the facts here, but now I want to give the background. So how did the Rav become so famous? And let's understand something. The Rav is in a little classroom. I once made a cheshbon over 44 years of teaching Torah in NYU. How many students were in the Rav's shir? How many students sat in his room? Maybe 3,000. If that much. Let's think what we're talking about. First of all, in order to sit in the Rav Shir, you had to have tremendous background. Rav Heschel Schachter claims that until his era, until our era, someone in the class told me this, that you didn't have enough students who could appreciate Rav. I don't know if that's entirely true, but certainly number-wise, there simply weren't enough Orthodox people in America. When the Rav started teaching in the early 40s, he had 18, 19 students in the room. I think it was Rabbi Wurzberger told me when the Rav went to onset for the summer, he sent each student a card. "How are you? Regards. Enjoy the summer. Chazak v'ematz." Joseph Soloveitchik sent each student a card. You understand? It was a different era. How many? And I don't know if Reb Heschel's right to say that we have better background than Walter Wurzberg. I mean, you know, let's be a little humble here. To say that we have better background, I'll mention a name that none of you heard of, unfortunately. Only we heard. Reb Tzvi Dov Kanatopsky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. The name mean anything to you? Rav Kanatopsky was the rabbi of the Israel Crown Heights. Young Israel of Crown Heights. And he was a Rosh Yeshiva in BTA. He was probably one of the Rav's best talmidim out of the 40s. He was Malei V'Gadosh, please. But how did they, so Rav Tzvi Kanatopsky, Rav Walter Wurzberger, and I'll tell you something else too. The students of the 40s never dreamt of being Rashi Yeshiva. The rabbinate was their dream. At that point, the Rashi Yeshiva were all coming from Europe with survivors, were Pleitei Cherev. What American guy could dream? He's going to equal a Mir. He's going to equal a fella from... You know, I often say, I can take it, don't think I'm boasting, but I have a better feeling of Pesach Halacha than many of my rabbis. I remember Rav Yochum Gerelika, Machlekes, the Mishnah Brua, the Erech HaShulchan, Vikam and Paskin, you know, he used to throw up his hands. How can you Paskin if it's a Machlekes? All right, you have to have a feeling. Jack knows, I've said many times, the Erech HaShulchan as a posek is a posek mufak, and the Mishnah Brua is rather to put Shita together. And then I found Rav Yosef Eliyohankin says exactly what I said years ago, and I was so happy. Rav Henkin says it black and white, yes. Right? No, he was a posek. The Mishnah Berurah teaches you how to put together Yotzei Tzayin Shita. He counts up. A posek can't count. A posek has to have a certain deher, certain. But I remember, thank you. So now I was like covering Ladas, Rabbi Yosef Elhung, and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Daniel, you've made my day. Now, but I had Rebellion, you know, we were kids. Who could be like the European crowd? Today, Baruch Hashem, I remember Rabbi Yerucham Melding used to say, "Min gate that I'm when you pass in a shiler, it's like going into a chamber, you know, to do a scientific experiment, no outside influence." He didn't know what he was talking about. You're learning Yoredeya, Hefsid Meruba, Erev Shabbos, Archim. What is that if not outside influence? You follow me? Then you have to have a chush for Pesach, you have to understand. Our Baruch Hashem, we know a little bit. I can also assure you, there's sugyas that we've gone into. For instance, I worked at the International Dateline. I'm not sure so many of my rabbeim had the International Dateline. It can drive you crazy. Pshutoka mashmo. You understand? I'll take a sugya that people talk about. Don't know what they're talking about. Yontif Sheni Shel Galut. You understand? I'm not Hashem, Baruch Hashem. But we were kids growing up. The rabbeim are from Europe. By the 1950s, Europe was dried up. And we could dream about becoming Rashi Yeshiva, which of course was my dream and Reb Heschel's dream and my whole era, Jerry Blau and Moshe Yaget. I mean, so many of the fellows I sat with became Gedolei Rashi Yeshiva, Gedolei Talmid Reb Abraham Spiegel. I mean, Baruch Hashem, you saw the picture, we all sat there together, pictures don't lie. Now, so, but how many students did the Rav have? Make a Cheshbon began with 1920, in my time there was 35 in this year. We hit 40, 45 in my later days. The 60s already you had 70, 75. The 70s you had 100, 120 dummies sitting there. I walked into the room, I forgot what year already. I was visiting America. It was like a whole yeshiva sitting there. But I don't know how many guys heard the Rav. The guys, the 20 guys from front. Am I right or wrong? I don't know, you've heard stories. The 20 guys from front heard the Rav, listened to the Rav. The guys in back, I don't know if the Rav knew their name. They were, it wasn't my days, the Rav knew every guy by name. You were frightened out of your wits, lest he call on you, you understand. But that was the first year by the Rav. Afterwards, I wasn't so frightened, I have to be honest. But we were frightened. We the Rav was a tyrant yet. But by the 70s, he was a Zeta with 120 guys sitting there. 20 of them were listening, 100 guys were daydreaming. Nevertheless, you know, there's the famous story with Shurkin. I don't know if you know the story with Shurkin. Shurkin denies the story, but I've heard it from so many witnesses that claim it's true. The Rav is taking attendance. This is in the 70s already. And Shurkin had just gotten, Shurkin was related to the Rav. Distant relation, whatever it was. He had a unique relationship with the Rav. So his father was a Sheshiv and Chaim Berlin, and Shurkin is Shurkin. So the Rav says, "Shurkin, what are you doing here? You just got married. You're on Shabbat brachas." So he says, "Rebbe, I made a deal with my wife that even in Shabbat Brachas I go to your shir." The Rav said, "Masnel Masha Kosev Bataira, what are you talking about? He threw him out of the shir. He said, go be with your wife, come back next week." But I mean, the Rav, by the 70s, he was a Zeta. In my time, the only shir I missed in my all the years I sat before the Rav was the day after I was married. And I never was able to make that shira properly. No one, if you didn't hear the master, you were lost. And I came the next, 2 days after I was married, I was in shira. The Rav didn't throw me out, he understand. But by the 70s, he was a Zeta. Shurkin, what are you doing here? Threw him out.
Uh,
Rav Aaron Kahn had a deal with the Rebbe. He would come to Shiv. He wasn't called on for the first day. I just want to put him to the type. No, beside that, that's the, of course, he came probably early 70s. He still heard who the, but by the mid 70s, come on, the Rebbe was a Zayda, no longer a Terah. But now my question, you see, there's a tremendous difference here between the Rav and the Lubavitcher Rebbe. A chassid, the Rebbe at one Fabrengen spoke to more people than the Rav ever spoke to in his year. Think what I'm telling you. One Fabrengen. If you went to Crown Heights, the 770, for the sake of argument, in the 60s and the 70s, there were 8,000-9,000 people there. Forget about the telephone hookups all over the world. Forget about later the satellite hookups. Forget about the closed circuit TV. There were 8,000-9,000 people all over the place. There were loudspeakers. It was mind-boggling. And not only that. And this is my famous story, and it's worth thinking about this. No one understood it ever. I was there in 1978, I think it was. You'd bet Thomas. I take a look. Everyone is sitting around with earphones. I don't know what's going on. I'm the only guy there without earphones. And then I found out everyone is having an English translation, a simultaneous English translation by a YU graduate, a teacher from Stern College, Alta Ben-Zion Metzger, and they're all hearing a simultaneous translation. Could you imagine 9,000 people and maybe a few hundred understand what the Rebbe is saying in his language? A few years later in Israel, I was at a Fabrengen at Talmud, got me a gift, a ticket. I paid heavy money, but the guy gives me a ticket that he paid 50 shekel. I have to go. I was at Binyan Ehuma, 4 o'clock in the morning. 4 o'clock. Let me just think. 4? Yeah. 4 o'clock in the morning, 9 o'clock in Crown Heights. I couldn't believe my eyes because I don't understand this modern technology. On the screen, there's the Rebbe. There's the Fabeng in his first beginning. There's Rav Flushin, Rav Chodkov. There's everyone. Jackson, there's Rabbi Gordon, the Fabeng in his first beginning. There's Rav Label Grona. I couldn't believe my eyes on the screen. And there, as I'm enthralled and enthused, I look around, everyone with long beards and black clothes with earphones. Everyone, direct Hebrew translation. The only moron in the place who understood the Rebbe in the original language was Aaron Rakafet. You understand? Now look what I'm saying, Mordechai, there's something so deep here. Could you imagine sitting in front of the Rebbe and you don't understand English? Danny Greer. Danny Greer sat there one year, was in Yiddish. He destroyed all of Torah in America as a result. Finish. It came to an end. One year. Think what I'm telling you. Danny Greer suffered for one year. But the Lubavitcher Rebbe, here the Rebbe speaking Yiddish. A Litvish Yiddish. You've ever heard the Rebbe say, I have tapes of the Rebbe. It's fabulous Yiddish. A Litvish Yiddish. It's not a Polish, it's not a Galitzani Yiddish. It's a white Russian Yiddish. That's where Lubavitch was. And here there are 9,000 people, 50,000 people listening. Okay, I'll tell you a different story. I was involved. I'm not afraid to admit it anymore. What the worst that can happen is I wind up in the New York Times. I was involved in helping sort out tapes of the Rav. This is the 1990s. So I needed space. It was a big problem. How to get space. So one of my dear friends who has a tremendous office, not a poor individual, a Lubavitcher, but the Talmud of the Rav as well, gave me in his office, Baruch Hashem, at my disposal, room, space, and a meshuris to do whatever I want. Kol HaKavod. And ordered in dinner for me with Luigi Siegel. I never ate better in my life. Those were the days. Ein ani yut b'makom ashirut. And a mincha marav at 4 o'clock over his loudspeaker, 770, code 770. 50 guys in the room where they hold conferences, the conference room, and elegant chairs, Shir and Tanya, 4:15 mincha. It's unbelievable. All Chabadnikim. So this Chabad kid from Los Angeles is working for me. Baal Tshuva, his parents, Baal Tshuva, came to New York. His mother, parents, the my usual story. And the kid is telling me, I became friendly with the kid. Kid did help me. And the kid says, Rabbi Rakefet, you should know I'm not changing one syllable. I have 1,000 tapes of the Rebbe. So I say to him, you know Yiddish, you understand Yiddish. Kid is a fifth generation American. Says, no. I says, what do you have 1,000 tapes? They're all in Yiddish. He says, I can understand one tape, two tapes. He says, oh, each tape, I feel a different inspiration. Could you picture talking to the Rav like this? Rabbi, ich verstehe nicht ein Wort, was er sagt in Englisch, aber ich kriege als Seife his palut von euch. Ihr kennt nicht der Grave, der Griechen. Could you picture talking to the Rav like that? Yes, you'd be on a rocket to the moon. Alice, to the moon. You understand? Rakefa, to the moon. Could you, so listen to what I'm saying. Oh, but there's a tremendous difference here. A Hasidic Rebbe, you don't come to understand. Faket. The less you understand him, the greater the Rebbe is in your eyes. Hasidic Rebbe, you come to be inspired. Those of you that have a little Hasidus in you, you come to be inspired. They look at the Rebbe. Oh, Rebbe, I have students. I understand them. Well, they latch on to me. I have students like when I'm in America, they liven up. One of them, his mother, should live me well, told me, when you come to America, my son is reborn. I understand them. They're happy in the presence of the Rebbe. It ties them up. It brings them to their days when they were learning Torah in Yerushalayim, Yahakodesh. I understand it. A Rebbe, you go to a Rebbe, just watching him, just hearing his tone, just hearing him cry, just hearing him laugh. It inspires you. You have to be a chassid to appreciate this. Daniel, if you're not a chassid, take my words verbally. You won't understand me. But if you have a chassidish soul, you can understand it. And this is why 50,000 people can be listening, Labriyut, can be listening to Lubavitcher Rebbe, even though they don't understand one word of Yiddish. But they're inspired. It's the Rebbe. It's his movements. It's his smile. It's his talk. It's his eyes. You ever see the Lubavitcher Rebbe's eyes when he looked at you, when he held up that cup, L'chaim, and he's looking at 5,000 people now, 5,000 standing here, and he looks at them, 5,000 pairs of eyes, each chassid believes the Rebbe is looking at me. Then he turns, and he looks at the other 5,000, and that's the Rebbe. So, okay, you can understand the Rebbe's influence. How did the Rebbe have so much influence? You couldn't walk into that classroom and not understand him. You couldn't walk into the classroom in my time if you didn't know Yiddish. You couldn't walk into the classroom in the 70s, into the 80s, the 60s, if you didn't know English. Philosophic English, at the Rav's English, was not a simple English. How did he have so much influence? And that's what I want to relate to now. You see, yes, had the Rav only been a classroom teacher, his influence would have been very limited. It would have been limited to the chosen few. Perhaps 3,000 students. I may be overstating the case, but let's give the benefit of the doubt that from 1941 to 1985, the Rav had over 3,000 students who sat in his classroom, who understood him, and learned, and were filled with Teirin Yerid Shemayim, and looked to the Rav as their Rebbe. But there was another aspect of the Rav. And it all begins with the first Yahrzeit Shir, 1942. The Rav gave public lectures. He went beyond the classroom. Nothing will ever equal the some odd 40 Yahrzeit Shiurim he gave in memory of his father. The Rav was very attached to his father, very close to his father. The Rav said time and again, I write about it in my book, but he said, the Weltmacht, I heard the Rav, when I speak to you now, I hear, one ear I'm talking to you, and one ear I hear Rebbe speaking. The Weltmacht atos. The world makes a mistake. Zei prakling asa b'chohot mevi ein Rebbe. The world thinks that more than one Rebbe. He's referring to Rav Chaim Heller. He says, nein, das ist nicht demes. Ich hab no got ein Rebbe, mein Tata. The Rebbe had only one Rebbe, his father. He had a unique relationship with Rav Chaim Heller that I explained last year. It's all on tape. You can pick it up. Rabbi Lichtenstein, interesting. You'll see that everything I've said is right there in that tape. In other words, there's nothing Rabbi Aaron's saying that I haven't said in class. It's fascinating. It makes me feel good because Rabbi Aaron certainly knew the Rebbe inside out. And he talks about Rav Chaim Heller here. Exactly what I said. Father image. Remember I said a father substitute? That's the exact word Rabbi Aaron uses. So the Rav Takenhan had only one Rebbe, Reb Moshe. He was very dedicated to his father. His father was very dedicated to him. If you've read Shulamit Meiselman's memoir, I don't have to tell you a big secret. There's a lot of resentment by the other children. Not Rabban. Rabban Salvechik was too young. He never knew his big brother as in the house. By the time Rabban grew up, the Rav was out of the house. Rabban was born in 1918, and the Rav left for Berlin in 1926. So for, you know, as a little kid, maybe his brother Beryl played ball with him, rolled up, if you read, you see the Rav's description of what he had to play ball. He rolled up paper, made a ball out of it, and that's what they could afford. And maybe played ball with Rabban. But Rabban certainly has no resentment. But if you read the Soloveitchik heritage, you'll see Rav Shmuel suffered, the girl suffered, because Rav Moshe had one child that he gave all his life to, and that was his eldest son, my Rebbe, your Rebbe, once removed, etc. And that's life. It's not a criticism, it's a fact of life. The Rav is very devoted to his father. His father died suddenly. Now, there's a lot to be said here, psychologically. Those of you, Lo Aleinu, you shouldn't have this, Lo Tosifu L'Davod, you shouldn't have this ever sit shiva for many, 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 many decades to come. But there's a big difference if your father dies slowly or dies suddenly. Slowly, you're prepared for it psychologically, you say goodbye. The Rav's father died like that, out of the clear blue. Heart attack. Was expected to recover. Aggravation. Shlomit Meiselman attributes her father's death. I mean, it's just mind-boggling to the fact that there was opposition to the Rav in YU, the opposition we spoke about, to succeeding his brother, to succeeding his father as the Rosh Yeshiva. And Shlomit Meiselman attributes her father's ultimate heart attack to that aggravation, that there was so much opposition to the Rav. Everything we spoke about last term. Barry, come closer. Don't sit so far. There's a seat here. Sit in front. So the Rav's father died suddenly. I may be wrong, I may be right. Some of you have studied psychology. I think a large part of the Yahrzeit Shir was not just the son who loved his father, not just the Talmud that loved the Rebbe. I think it was also a son who never had a chance to say goodbye properly to his father. Now, the Rav, for those Yahrzeit Shirs, prepared something indescribable. It is beyond description. The Rav in the classroom was prepared. But even when you say he was prepared, it was a shir he was thinking. He could come in, you all know the famous stories that everyone has immortalized. He could come in and I saw it with my own eyes and he would say, everything I told you last week was wrong, cross it out. One fellow in the class had asked a question on Wednesday. The Rav said I went back to Boston. I kept on thinking and thinking about that question. My entire interpretation was wrong. And 1 week later, he totally redid the sugya, totally redid the shir. The Yahrzeit shir, the preparation was indescribable. First of all, there was the halacha. And he took brisker themes. Tumuhutra b'tziba, chutcha b'tziba, sitzit, klayim, onig v'kibit shambat. It took brisker themes from all of Shas. Only in later years, I'll come to it, he remained basically in this vista of Orach Chaim. But he took from all of Shas. And he developed brisker Torah as only he could until the end. And then at the end of 2.25 hours of brisket Torah, where he gave out the Maram HaKoymus before, and everything was worked out to the Nekudah Rona, he then went into a philosophic discourse of Hashkafa that was just overwhelming. No one in the generation could come near him in the second half. The first half, Mela. Rabbi Aaron Cutler was alive. There were others that had mastered great brisk lamdanis. Revelva was alive. No one had the Rebbe's ability as an orator, as a speaker, as a teacher. He was Chad Bedaro. Everyone admitted that. From the Lubavitcher Rebbe to Rabbi Simcha Goldberg to Rabbi Aaron Cutler, Chad Bedaro and his Koach of Hezbah. But all right, on the first level, I'm willing to admit perhaps there were others in the generation that could come somewhere near him. I say somewhere. The second half, it went on for another 2 hours. You were flabbergasted. The dashanut, the sermonics, the philosophy. Certain years it was Kabbalah. He took Kabbalistic. I'll never forget. I did it in the Kollel, Din Rafya, Din Kasha. It was just overwhelming. The energy he put into it is beyond imagination. The longest share I gave in my life was my chesed for Joe DiMaggio. That share went almost 3 years. It's my greatest piece of Torah ever. It's my chesed for Joe DiMaggio. That's my epitaph. It was almost 3 hours. I was exhausted. The Rav, 5.5 hours, I'm an eyewitness. This is the Rav in his prime. Now, the Yahrzeit share attracted everybody. See, here already, it broke all barriers. Guy sneaked in to New York from Lakewood, cut off their beards, got rid of their black yarmulkes. Fellas came in for Torah Vadas, hid their payas. No, I'm not exaggerating. You have no hasaga, because there were people watching. If you go, you're an apikoros, you understand. It was a mob scene. Lakewood, Chaim Berlin, Torah Vadas, Mir, the yeshiva, Nathan Lamport was filled, standing room only. Where do you get so many Jews? This is the 50s. But by that time already, when you take Torah Vadas and Chaim Berlin and Beis Yosef and Lakewood and Brooklyn and Beis Medrash Shalyon and Lubavitch and anyone who had to learn, you couldn't come if you didn't know how to learn. You'd be bored stiff. You're not going to sit 5 Aryeh Shtekla. Moshe Shochet. Where's Moshe Shochet? Effie Green. Eli Babish. Don't see him. Uri Grossberg. Hanoch Davidman. Seth Schenker. Wouldn't you Shimon yesterday? What does your wife call you? That's what I want. Although when my wife calls me, it can't be repeated. Many different names, depending on her mood. Anywhere from Arnold to Bruce, etc. And each name has a history. I've been Bruce for 40 years when I'm on good terms. I've been Arnold for 40 plus years when I'm on bad terms. Done something wrong, like didn't wash the dish properly. But men always get the last word, and yes, dear, it's a pleasure. Ira Eben. Ira Eben. Jacob Vidomlansky. These guys are ghosts. They're on the list. They're not here. Aryeh Blum. Joshua Spereri. Barry Goldfish. Mordechai Kaplan. Anyone whose name I didn't call. Okay, let me... I know most of the names already. Okay, now let me continue. I'm sorry. I just want to work on the lecture. It's so important. You should understand what happened. Those Yahrzeit Sheyurim. It's... all over, even in Lakewood. I remember when I learned in Lakewood, so after the outside shiur, one of the fellows told me, the Mashkich Reb Moshe, he's dead already. When the Muyot in Lakewood, it's Reb Moshe Heisman's uncle of Ne Yisrael. So he had an uncle as a Talmud of Reb Aaron Kotliyot from Kletz. So the boy said to me, Reb Moshe Heisman says exactly what the Rav said. Yes, he doesn't say this beautifully. They admitted that. But you know, the Rav was just sword. That left an unbelievable impact. It took the Rav way out of the confines of the narrow classroom in which he taught. Now, I've said this many times, I want to say it for posterity. One of the saddest moments when I look back in life, Eitan, when you look back, what could have been is the saddest words of all. And Aaron, I don't have many regrets in my life. I wanted to be three things: a Gaon, a Tzaddik, and a Rebbe. A Gaon I didn't become, a Tzaddik I didn't become. But Baruch Hashem, I sure became a Rebbe. As a matter of fact, you don't realize you did something last night that never happened in 42 years of teaching Torah. You don't realize, when I finished the shiur, some of you applauded. And I walked out, I said, Ashreinu shezachinu lakach, that a Rebbe should be appreciated by Talmidim. Don't think I don't appreciate your applause. I do, 1,000,000%. And God should help me give you the best of the best. So, you know what I regret? Jack Mills. A picture I never took. Because no one can believe what I'm about to describe. You know why we didn't take the picture? Because youth has a foolish feeling that they will live forever. You fellas are young, you're in Shira Shirim. Joshua's going to be here forever. The Rebbe's going to be here forever. The microphone is going to be here forever. The building, you know, nothing. When I was your age, the same thing. A world without the Rav? Impossible. Impossible. The Shatzai Shiur was 8 o'clock at night, 7:30 at night. If you came in to Nathan Lamport at 9 o'clock in the morning, hundreds upon hundreds of chairs, I can see the sight before my eyes, little notes reserved for Joshua Spori. Next to it, a guy left his hat on the chair. Next to it, a guy left sperm on the chair. You go rowing back, a guy left his jacket on the chair. Hundreds, the heart of the auditorium, 10 hours before the shiur had to begin. The box seats are ready. Couldn't get one empty box seat. The grandstand seats, half gone already. By midday, all you had left were bleacher seats. And if I could have only taken that picture of the empty auditorium with the notes, with the hats, with the books, with the jackets, I would have marked the picture. Kavod HaTorah. Kavod HaTorah. What a sight. What the Yahrzeit Shiur was. I have in my book the audience in the 50s at the Yahrzeit Shiur. I can find myself in the picture. I'm looking down. I'm writing. Interestingly, compare that picture with the pictures of the crowds at the Yahrzeit Shiurs in the 70s, and you'll see how differently we dressed. The 50s, we wore jackets, we wore ties. You look at the picture out of the 70s, everyone is with an open shirt, no jacket, no tie. Interesting how times changed. A little bit is the Israeli influence. Okay, that was the Yahrzeit Shiur for Reb Moshe. And that Yahrzeit Shiur remained in Yiddish. It never changed. Like everything else around the Rav's legacy, and we'll come to it later, we will never have all the Yahrzeit Shiurs. We have, we don't have, published, not published, who has which tape, who has which manuscript, what's lost. The best that we have are the two volumes, She'erim L'Zecha, Abba Murray. It was published by Reb Yitzchak Twesky. Chaim Soloveitchik opposed publishing it. The Rav gave Yitzchak a letter. It's the end already where the Rav Bailey is functioning. Gave Yitzchak a letter thanking him for publishing it. Chaim was upset. And this leads us to a problem we'll discuss later today or next time. Perfectionism. When do you publish? If you're going to wait for something to be perfect, when will you publish? I don't know. We all suffer from it. I can tell you in Australia, I picked up a student who became very enthralled with yours truly. His name is the richest Torah Jew in the world, a guy named Yessel Legutnik. He stopped all activity. You know what it means for a multi-billionaire to stop all activity at night, come to every shiur with his wife, sit there like a kid, taking notes with his bodyguard standing at the door, hundreds of people. It added, certainly, I was held in such prestige, and part of it was that Yessel came and sat there like a kid. He wanted to have his secretary type it out from the tape and publish it at his expense. What does it mean? A few thousand dollars to him? It's like I give a penny to Tzedakah, half a penny to Tzedakah. But I told him, yes, sir, listen, I'm not afraid to publish. I've published 6 books already. But I have to wait till I'm ready. I just can't take an isolated shiur. So he wanted to treat it like the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The secretary types it into print, finished. All right, maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. But a little bit I inherited that from my Rebbe. We'll never have the full gestalt of the Yahrzeit Shiur. What's lacking, and I disagree with Chaim, thank God we have She'erim L'Zecha Abba Murray. But if anyone would have consulted me, first of all, put down a date when the shiur was said. That's very important. Because it's important to know if they're saying the 50s, the 60s, the 70s is very important. Number one. For obvious reasons. Number two. Why didn't they publish the Agada with the Halacha? Why separate it? The Rav, you know what I'm talking about? You could cry. It's so thwarting, so frustrating. If you had the manuscript for the Halacha, then it means you had the manuscript for the Agada. Why didn't you publish the two together? Why? Shimon, why do you deprive the world? Now, the Rav said many times that he got his ideas in the Drush from the Medrash V'Maisa. Who's the Medrash V'Maisa? How many of you have read Rakefet's Revel? The Medrash V'Maisa. Rabbi Yecheskel Lifshitz. He almost became a Rosh Yeshiva in YU. Had he only remained in America, who knows how different our story would have been. Rabbi Revel loved him. The Rav said that the only Svarim that Rav Chaim had on his desk among Shas and Paiskim was the Medrash V'Maisa. Rav Chaim had both volumes on his desk from the Kalish Rav. That's how much. No, how many of you have looked at the Medrash V'Maisa? What is the Medrash V'Maisa? Effie, it's every Pasha. First the Halacha, then the Drush. First the Halacha, then the Drush. So, Uri, if the Rav worshipped the Medrash V'Maisa the same way he worshipped the Medrash V'Maisa, Aryeh, the same way that he published the Halacha and the Drush, why didn't the Rav publish? Why didn't his family put it out with the Halacha and the Drush? You're missing the Gadlut, the Ma'ov, the beauty, the giant, the greatness. No answer. That's the tragedy. You take Family Redeemed, put out from manuscript. What they did with the footnotes, it's impossible to use. Look at it, see what I'm saying. Consult with people. Everyone here is working secretively. Consult, Baruch Hashem. The Rav organized footnotes, cross-index. I worked 1 year on the indexing alone. No one in any review said thank you on that. A book, totally available, totally open. You can find anything in a moment. But there are ways to do it. You understand? No one consults. Everyone does. Hop-lop. Everyone's working. One foundation, another foundation, third foundation. It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy, but there's no solution. The years moved on. A very interesting change happened in the outside sphere, and I call it to your attention. The years moved on. What does that mean, the years moved on? Number one, the crowd became unbelievably larger and unbelievably more widely dispersed, different types of people. First of all, what we call modern orthodoxy today or westernized orthodoxy, the right-wing world is much larger, the YU world is much larger. Not only that, an unbelievable amount of women started to learn Torah. Remember, this is a revolution. How many women learned Torah years ago? They tell me in the latest issue of Tchumim, there's an article by a daughter of a student of mine. I have to see it. They say the woman who became a Yoetzet Halacha, I have the first two women. One was my student, Dr. Zimmerman, and one is Leah Weiss's daughter, Baron. She's a daughter of a student of mine. Say, she has an article in Tchumim. You know what that means? An article in Tchumim. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, I've told you a million times, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein's mother, when she wrote articles for the Tells Torah Journal, she wrote under the pseudonym of a boy. Blima became Binyamin. Ask Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein to tell you about it. Could you imagine? His mother had to take a pseudonym of the male, George Eliot, because otherwise they were not going to publish her article in the Tells Torah Journal. You follow me, Aryeh? Today, Baruch Hashem, Aryeh Bloom, it's a different world. So you had women coming, men coming. So the Rav shifted gears. Beginning with the late 60s, early 70s, all the Yahrzeit drushes invariably centered around, say, the Moed or Or HaChaim. And the Rav was asked why? Because he felt these were topics that the Olam understood. He was no longer getting just 2,500, 3,000 like with Tayra Vadas Chaim Berlin boys, but he now was getting an audience with an overflow crowd. At times later on, there were two overflow crowds close circuiting to the Beis Medrash, close circuiting to Morgenstern. There was no end to how many people wanted to fill an auditorium of 10,000 wouldn't have been big enough already by the late 70s, 80s. It's a credit. It's late 70s, I have to say, mid 70s, 80s already you don't have. But it's a credit to Orthodoxy, which has exploded on the American scene, Kanayin Hara. And with this type of audience, he chose topics that were tangible. In other words, to say a shir on tumuchutra betzima, tumuchutcha betzima, you're not going to be able to reach these people. They don't have the kalim for it. To say a shir on klayim and tzitzit, you're not going to have people with the kalim for it. But to come in with kriyat haTorah, to come in with yalav v'yavo, people know what you're talking about. Kiddush, havdalah, etc. Only to keep it Shabbat. People know what you're talking about. So that was the audience launcher. The theme was more focalized on Moed. And then there was a third very interesting change that worked out very brilliantly. This change begins because the Rav simply is older. You can no longer give a 5-hour shir. You could no longer give endless halacha and endless agada. You know what the Rav did? He shifted the halacha and agada into one. Rabban talks about it on the tape too. You'll hear it. Something I've always spoken about. And no one else could ever do this. I've never seen anyone in the world that had this ability. No, I mean in modern times, could be you'll find, I don't know, but in modern times, to take a halachic topic and shift it into the most magnificent musa, philosophy, theology. Classic example, when the Rav dealt with Simchat Beit HaShoeva, Shira B'peh, Shira B'kli, one of the early 1970 Yahrzeit drushes. I just met the Rav of Rechavia and he heard the drusha recently. He was shaking, still shaking, Rav Zalman Druk. He's repeated over to me the Meridik, what the Rav said when he reaches the Agada with the shofar, when you can no longer express it in words, we express it, the Negina that has no words, man, is incapable. At this point, we just call out to God like an animal because we realize we can't say it in our words. That's what shofar represents and how the Rav develops that from the halacha into the philosophy, theology, agada, dashanut. Aaron, unbelievable. And you see part of it in the Shirim L'Zeicha B'Mori, because the Shirim L'Zeicha B'Mori are not balanced. It has more of the later manuscripts than the earlier manuscripts. Although they are from the 1950s there as well, and in my two volumes I have practically every shir marked off what year it was given. But those that were given during the classic period, you cry because the Agada is missing. Those that were given during the latter period, there already they had no choice because the Halacha and the Agada blended, flowed one into the other. That's the outside shir, L'Zecher Reb Moshe. Everyone who lives through it knows Gimel Shvat. Whenever Gimel Shvat comes around, I feel that pull. Where's the outside shir? What's happening tonight? It all comes back to mind. And I'll never forget one Yahrzeit shir in the late 50s where the Rev reached the height of heights with the Dashanut afterwards with Moshe Rabbeinu, Alei Bahar Hazed, this week's Sedra Hazinu, and Vezot HaBracha, and how he describes the final moments of Moshe's life, and he ends off with Moshe's death. And I'll never forget, there wasn't a dry eye in the audience. It was 12:30, a quarter to one at night. We had sat down for the Yahrzeit drasha 5 hours earlier. It was a beautiful night. The stars were out. The height of winter. came out, 2 feet of snow on the ground. No one paid attention, no one noticed. I remember I couldn't get a bus. Bus just stopped running. I walked back to the Bronx, didn't even realize I was floating on the air. I was in an ecstatic, different world. That was the Rav. No one ever forgot that drasha. I've met people 40, 50 years later, and they remember that drasha with Moshe Rabbeinu as if it happened a minute ago. That was the Yotzei drasha. That pushed the Rav into tremendous public acknowledgement, tremendous public feeling. It's not a Rebbe, not a Hasidish feeling. But people related. What a mind. What a message. What depth. What brisk. What velashim. What Reb Moshe. What Reb Chaim. And then the Rav's uniqueness in the Haggadah / Hashkafa / philosophy / theology, eschatology, etc. Of course, there were other public talks. The most famous is the Tshuva Drasha, which interestingly enough, like the Yotzei Drasha for Reb Moshe, never left the Yiddish language. In other words, Joshua, in the Reb's mind, these two drashot, one in January and one in September, these two drashot were the heart of the Reb's message. He had to be in Yiddish. He had to be at home. Reb Moshe was alive during these drashot. Reb Chaim was alive. The Beit HaLevi was alive. The Netziv was alive. This was the essence of the Reb. That's why I said an hour ago that I think deep down he would be more at home with Reb Chaim Ilson than with Rabbi Dr. Jeffrey Wolf. I think it was the essence. This was the essence of the Reb. He never changed the Yiddish. Now, the Tshuva Drasha is very fascinating, how it began and how it remains. See, this is something most people don't know, and I call attention to the future person who will write the history of the Rav. I'm giving you the facts now. It began Rabbinical Council of America. As I said last year, when I described the Rav's relationship with the Rabbinical Council, by the early 50s, the Rav starts to become a dominant personality. And this is something many of you don't understand. The Rav as a kid was not the Rav. 1930s, he suffered. I speak about it. Hear the tapes of last year. Hear what I uncovered in Boston. He suffered. The 1940s, he was struggling. By the early 50s, he's the Rav. And he now starts to play a dominant role in RCA. And he now becomes chairman of the Halachic Commission. And Shimon, the rabbis come to him by 1954, Rebbe, give us Divrei Musa, Divrei Hitorerut before Yom Kippur. And the Rav acquiesced. And in 1954, he gave his first Tshuva Drasha. You know how big the crowd was? A few hundred rabbis from the greater New York area. That's how big the crowd was. People loved it. A year later, more came. And they had to open it to the public. And they always had to find a new venue, a new place to hold it. Ultimately, the crowd was in the thousands. And they used to hold it at the Y in 92nd Street, Lexington Avenue. Had a big auditorium. Do you know why it was never held at Yeshiva University? Haven't you wondered yet? Why wasn't the Tshuva Drasha ever held at Yeshiva University? Because the RCA insisted that they are the patrons of the Tshuva Drasha. They didn't want to lose that unique relationship with the Rav and give it over to Yeshiva University. The minute you go to Lampert Auditorium, it's a Yeshiva University drasha, not an RCA drasha. And the RCA insisted, we invented it, we created it, we are the ones that engendered it. This is the crown, the jewel in the crown of the RCA. This is the high point of the RCA year. And the RCA, all the years, they remain the sponsor of the tshuva drasha. It never left the arena, which they did not control. Thousands came, but it was RCA. Outsiders, endless, later years, endless women, and I have to tell you, Stern College, women who are learned, women who want to hear Musa before Yom Kippur, but it was RCA. Now, second only to the Tshuva Drushes, second only to the Yotzai Drushes, are the Tshuva Drushes. The Rav's innovativeness, the Rav's insight, the Halacha, the Agada, the Musa, I need not tell you. Even in Mir Yeshiva, hundreds of copies of Al HaTshuva are hidden under the Gemaras during this period of the year. People are overwhelmed. Once again, Mordechai, the old problem. The Rav did not publish. We don't have all the dreshes. What we have, the greatest amount that we have, was published against the Rav's will by Pinchas Peli. And therein is a fascinating story. Let me tell it for posterity. Pinchas Peli is from an old Yerushalayim family. His father was Rav Mordechai HaKohen, a family that lived in two worlds, Meir Sharim, and yet was open-minded. Rav Mordechai HaKohen had three sons. Each son sought to conquer the world. All of them inherited their father's ability. They were fabulous writers, had fabulous docile pens. Ultimately, one becomes an Orthodox rabbi, one a conservative rabbi, and one a reform rabbi. The eldest brother, Rav Menachem HaKohen, becomes the Rav of the Histadrut, Mapai member of the Knesset for many, many decades, lives in the Old City, published many books, was a high-ranking chaplain in the army under Rav Gorin, a high-ranking officer in the rabbinic corps. It's not exactly chaplaincy, it's the wrong word to use, but the rabbinic corps, because the rabbis in Israel are regular fighters and carry guns, as I can testify. He remained Orthodox, albeit Mapai Orthodox, but Orthodox. The other brother, Shmuel Avidur HaKohen, each brother has a different name. Here wound up father of sons who learn or learned in Panovich, wound up divorcing his wife, married some poetess from Kibbutz Shiloh, one of the most leftists of kibbutzim. He lives on the kibbutz. He's a reform rabbi, hard to comprehend. Pinchas Peli, who's not alive, became the conservative rabbi. He organized, he was a youngster, wrote poetry, went to see Zalman Shazar, who was then editor of Davar. You know what Davar was? The daily newspaper of the Mapai, Mifleget Avodah. Salman Shazan, whose youth was a Lubavitcher Chassid, and his old age, his president, went back to his roots. The middle of his life, he was a Mapainik. Salman Shazan sees this kid come in with payas, gives him poetry. Shazan loved it, encouraged him, published it under a pen name, Pinchas Peli. Al Teshu Lishmi Pelihu. That's how Pinchas HaKohen became Pinchas Peli. He later edits the first weekly religious magazine in Israel, Ayin Ba'ayin. It becomes Panim El Panim. That's where I learned my Hebrew from. And then he goes to America. Goes to America, teaches in YU, befriends the Rav. One of Bernard Revel graduate school's greatest mistakes ever, he wanted to get a doctorate. He comes to Bernard Revel, I have one more year to be in America. Can I get a doctorate here? What do I have to write? And Bernard Revel graduate school, with all their scholarly arrogance, tell him, go fly a kite. A year for a doctorate, it has to take 3, 4, 5, what do you think this is, a machine? Out of here, you pseudo scholar, you bum. Goes down to the seminary from 185th, he travels on the 7th Avenue down to 122nd and Broadway, goes into the seminary. Dr. Peli, 1 year, fine, we'll be happy to grant you a doctorate, write a little essay on this and that. Within a year, he's Dr. Peli. Goes back to Israel, he's Meshubad to the conservative movement. He is the first rabbi on Agron Street, and I can testify with my own eyes. I walked by 1970, peeked in, coming back from the Kotel on Rosh Hashanah, and there was Pinchas Peli sitting with men and women together, hard for my eyes to see it. He himself was from, his children are all from, his wife is from, a feminist, albeit from, everyone around him was from, but got a doctorate from the seminary, made panasa from the seminary, became rabbi of Agram Street, the seminary center in Jerusalem. Peli started publishing the Rav's Shuvah Drashot in Ayin Bayin, Panim El Panim. Had the Rav been younger, he would have chopped his head off. To quote the Medrash Rabbah with the relative of Yosef Ben Yossi, would have been Makayim Bo Dalit Mita Dayton, Skillah Strafe Herakhenik, all at once. Look into Bereshit Rabbah. The Rav would have gone hysterical. But by the early 70s, the Rav was starting to mellow. He was outlived his father, outlived his grandfather. It's a very important point. I'll come back to it next week. The Rav outlived his father and grandfather. By the early 70s, he started to mellow. And Peli got away with it. Well, Peli got away publishing upon him, and one Tshuva Drasha, I have it on tape, the Rav got up and in front of endless hundreds, thousands of people, the Rav began the Tshuva Drasha. The emesis, the truth is I didn't want to prepare a new shiur this year because you'd have forgot what I said last year. But he said there's one problem. Peli wrote it up in Panim El Panim, and he wrote it up so nicely, and you'll see it in print, so I have to give a new drasha. Mr. Rav's devilish sense of humor, that devilish sense of humor, boomeranged on him. Because Peli saw the Rav is praising him in public with Neyam Vieda. Peli put out all the drashot he had published, Al HaTshuva, published by the Torah Culture Department without permission. It's an amazing story. All the Rav got out of it, Tova told me, it's all the Rav got out of it with two free copies. Believe me, Ktav has treated me better than the Torah Culture Department and Pinchas Peli treated the Rav. But Peli put a lot of work in. He translated from Yiddish to Hebrew. And Peli's Hebrew, second to none. The Rav, let's put it this way, Bal Kocha Yaneh Amen, he was very pleased with the level on which it came out. It was a faithful translation. As I've told my students over the decades, there's only one sentence that Peli changed. One sentence. Outside of that sentence, Peli changed nothing. I have the tapes, I can listen to the original, and I have the Hebrew in front of me, and I can follow word by word what Peli did. He edited a little, made it a little clearer, but he changed absolutely nothing. One syllable, one paragraph he changed. I'll tell you about that in a second, just for the sake of historical accuracy. No, that's not a simple matter. Years later, when it became apparent that Peli is a conservative rabbi, so my good friend, photography editor, the Rav's photographer, Rabbi Irwin A. Albert, known as Uncle Roy to Eitan Holzer. So Rabbi Albert told me he, in a moment of discussion with the Rav, where they were fighting over pictures, and the Rav didn't want him to give a certain picture to a certain individual who the Rav suspected had non-orthodox or conservative tendencies. So Roy says to the Rav, but Rebbe, you let Peli write up your tshuva drasha, and he's a conservative rabbi in Jerusalem. And the Rav responded, first of all, I didn't let him write him up. You know, the Rav told him the story it was, but then the Rav said, but you should know, Rabbi Albert, you should know, he did a beautiful job. He did a beautiful job. And the Rav Taka, of all the Svarim that someone else did, because there was Isha Munah, translated English into Hebrew, the Rav was not that happy with the translation. But with Peli, the Rav was unbelievably happy, and he did a beautiful job. That's absolutely true. Now, obviously, once again, Peli didn't give the years that Rosh Hashanah given. You follow me, Aryeh? Once again, I could get these guys and slap their faces. Do it properly! It's important for future generations. In my Al HaTshuva, I have every drasha with the year in which it was given. It only covers the late 60s into the early 70s. Peli published it around 73, 74. So you have about six major tshuva drasha in the prime of the Rav's life. You're missing what came before. You're missing what came afterwards. The paragraph that Pelley edited, and I've said this over the years, but I'll repeat it now for future generations, is very fascinating. There's one drasha where the Rav speaks, L'chol techra kol bera, all knees have to bow before you, Daniel. And the Rav speaks in terms, we owe loyalty only to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to nobody else. And the Rav gets carried away in a drasha. It may have been ad-lib, not in the manuscript. And he says, and we don't, our loyalty to Medinat Yisrael is only if it observes Torah. But if Medinat Yisrael doesn't observe Torah, my loyalty is to God, my loyalty is to Torah, not to a land per se. My entire loyalty to Medinat Yisrael is because it represents Eretz Yisrael. But if they no longer represent Kedusha and Tara and Eretz Yisrael, then I don't have to be loyal. Only to God do we have absolute loyalty. There's no concept of absolute loyalty to a sovereign state, to a political entity. That's what the Rebbe said. Pelley edited it to read, only to God do we have total loyalty. We never have loyalty to any other concept. And among the examples, a sovereign state, family, friends, a sovereign state, a political entity, we don't have total loyalty. Only Lecha Techra Kol Berach, only to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Mordechai, what did Pinchas Pelley leave out? Medinat Yisrael. He changed the concept of Medinat Yisrael into a more generic concept. Medina, political entity. With me, Shimon? When Al Chatshuva appeared, this is something you fellas don't remember, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, was very active. He would publish Hashkafa statements in Hatzofa weekly. When Al Chatshuva appeared, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook saw the drasha and he read right through it. And he understood that the Rav wasn't talking about Afghanistan, and the Rav wasn't talking about outer Manchuria, and the Rav wasn't talking about communist China, and the Rav wasn't talking about Australia or New Zealand. The Rav was talking about Medinat Yisrael. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook came out in a Hashkafa statement, making Ashen Blatter out of this part. Chas v'chalila, it's not so. It's Israel is a concept unto itself. We have loyalty to Eretz Yisrael. It has nothing to do with the political reality which is upon it. Eretz Yisrael is part of the Torah. And whatever it was, that Friday in Hatzofa, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook took issue with the drasha, took issue with the Rav, but above all, saw right through the emendation and editing done by Pinchas Pelley. The tshuva drashot continued to be devilous. The Rav continued through 1980. The drashas were magnificent. Some of these drashas show up, edited by Moshe Cronin, the various volumes he put out for the Jewish Agency. Again, the Rav, the family, were very displeased with the level. It didn't reach their standards. Arnold Lustiger, who I don't know, but I can tell you that his second cousin, I believe it is, may very well become the next pope of the Catholic Church, which is just mind-boggling. Cardinal Lustiger of Paris, Shem Yishum Yerkov, is a Meshumad who became a Catholic, later becomes a priest. Archbishop, today the Cardinal of Paris, is an absolute, total, 100% Jew. And believe it or not, Cardinal Lustiger has a second cousin living in Greater Philadelphia, very brilliant individual, brilliant mind, scientist, became a Baal Tshuva. I don't think he ever saw the Rav in his life. He discovered the Rav through tapes, and he put out a very beautiful one volume in English, Lifnei Hashem Titaharu, before Hashem should you be purified. It's some of the later drashot organized in English, put into a crystal clear form, taking concepts of the Rav and making it, distilling them and making it available to the art scroll generation. I need not tell you that the family was not happy with what Lustiger did. Halavai, halavai, with all the foundations working, the foundation of the sisters, Tovra and Atara, the foundation of Chaim Soloveitchik, the foundation of Boston, of controlled by Avram, by Abe Lvovitz. Halavai, halavai, someone would collect all the manuscripts on the Tshuva Drasha and put out all those that Peli didn't cover. Put it out in Hebrew first, Lashon HaKodesh, the way Peli did. If you need an English translation, Peli translated into English as well. It was put out by Paulus Prest, of all places, on repentance, by Pinchas Peli, translated by Penina Peli. By the way, Peli's wife was an American from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Her father was a Rav on the West Side. Moshe Cohn, who wrote for the Jewish Jerusalem Post, Moshe Cohn, the great Moshe Cohn, who's no youngster anymore, should live me well, have a refuah shleima, the great, wonderful Moshe Cohn, is an older brother to Penina Peli. It is a brother-in-law to Pinchas Peli. So it gives you some idea of the family and what we're talking about. My dear students, gentlemen, rabbis, I have to. I have something to teach you after Sukkot. You want me to do it all? It's already. My watch is. No, I have what to do, but it's already 10. It's 10:32, and the boys have to. I got to live with Reb David Miller, and I have appointments also. I understand. We have to. Part of being a faculty person or being a human being is to be flexible and understand there are others in the world too. They have Reb David Miller, Reb Hetzel Hefta, Baron Lichtenstein. These guys have a full schedule. Gentlemen, to reiterate, we haven't finished, but at this point, we have to wish everyone well. What did we do? Today was a very important lecture, the Yahrzeit Shir. I hope I did it justice. There's a lot more in my book. I don't want to redo what I have in the book. You read the book. But I hope I did it justice. I wanted you to capture the feeling, the aura, the atmosphere, the chairs with the notes, the hats, the jackets, the books, the pens, the eyeglasses. It was just amazing what was left there to reserve a seat. A covered a Torah like that I never saw in my life. And I have to be honest with you, if I have any soul in me, any appreciation of Torah, it's due to the Yahrzeit Shir. The Shir we know we had mainly Shas, Poskim, Chaim. We didn't see the Rav's soul. The Yahrzeit Shir, you saw his soul. There are certain parts in my book that I write up from my notes out of the 50s from the Yahrzeit Shir. One part they used in Reshit Yeshiva, devoted a whole Shabbos to the theme. Just 3 pages in my book. They said it was overwhelming for the students. That was Bori Olamot, Machriv Olamot, Bori Olamot Machrivan. That the rebuilding after the Holocaust. That was in a Yahrzeit Shir. And those were the most moving moments ever. And you know something? Those were all ad-libbed. This is the tragedy of working from manuscript. You lose the heart of the Rav. You get the mind of the Rav. You don't get the heart. The heart was when he took off his glasses, that picture in my book with the glasses off, maybe Roy Albert's most famous picture, and when he ad-libbed, that's when the heart was speaking, not the mind. I've tried to do it justice. I went into the Tshuva Drasha. Fascinating. Did you ever realize that they refused to let YU take it over? They didn't want to lose their identity. They spent a fortune to rent the Y. The Y had a big auditorium, maybe even bigger than Lampert. But it had to be in the Y. It couldn't go uptown. It was interesting. That was the RCA's Tshuva Drasha. Gentlemen, there's more to go. I've made the following decision. I look through both volumes again. I tell you, I'm overwhelmed. It's the Rav. This is the Rav. I'm going to give an overlook on what I've done and what's important and what to call to your attention. It won't be as thorough as what I'm doing now in the biography because most of the insights speak for themselves. Aaron said perhaps it'll be a lot easier if you own the volume and you can actually write notes, make certain emendations on the side, certain comments. It might make the volume infinitely more valuable for you for years to come as Rabbanim, as Rashi Yeshiva, as Magidei Shir, as Balei Musa, or as just good Torah Jews. So it could be, Aaron said, why not collect orders and get it through Pomerantz and try to get a discount. As far as I recall, he charged for YU people $293 a set, which approximately works out about, what is it? No, it's less than that now. The dollar's going up. Anyway, deal with him. See what you can do. Maybe it should be less because the dollar is less. But if you get enough orders, deal with him. Tell him we have 20 orders for 20 sets. And let Naomi Rosenshine deal with him. You know what I'm talking about? She's my student. All the women working here basically today are my students. So Lorraine is not, but I know Lorraine so many years. She's like my student. Shoshana's like my student. The other women are all my students. Talk with Naomi. See what she can do. It'll be a lot easier if you have the books in front of you. Finally, press conference, every student who comes gets a $10,000 gift from the Rebbe. Jack, on the IU list, minus $10,000. The reason is very simple. If you know what it means to teach for YU, they don't even know my name from a hole in the ground. The only reason I'm here is because when the kollel began, the boys brought me in to teach. It was Baal Kocham al Apam v'chamatam. Later they brought me in to give a second shiur. When I started giving a second shiur, and Sokol had to approve a pittance of salary, Sokol exploded. Who the hell is Rothkopf? I learned. What does he know? He gives one class, it's enough. Who needs two classes from him? But the boys insisted, so I gave two classes. I have no father to fight for me, no father to fight me, so I don't have to tell you. To teach for you, it's not a pleasure, as far as the way they treat you. But nevertheless, to the advantages, I have the brightest, greatest B'nai Torah in the world to talk to. And I have to let off steam. I'm very upset. So the press conference enables me to reveal my heart to you. We make enough tapes that goes all over the world. Hundreds hear it, agree, disagree. It's interesting. So by honoring me by coming on Som Gedalia at 9 o'clock, it's $10,000 to you from the Rebbe for giving me the ability to let off a little steam and say what's on my mind at this moment in history. And I want to wait till after Rosh Hashanah says to make tshuva. I want to be sure I have Yirat Shemaim in front of me, and I say what I say, what I think. I may be wrong, I may be right, but if I don't say it, I won't survive. Gentlemen, it's $10,000 apiece. The more that come, the more money that goes out. The sky's the limit. I have good bankers rolling me. I want to wish you all a tiva v'tima tov, the safest shots, the dikim, the murm, l'shnat chayim, osha v'yosha v'kolt of selah, bayit haguf unahorim ma'alya. And it should be a new beginning. Klal Yisrael needs us. Open your hearts to greatness in Torah, greatness in Yirat Shemayim, and halavai we should be zocha to a marvelous year and a gula shlema. Thank you so much. Cult of Sela. Das Vedanya. Oh, here's the Rabbi Lookstein document. I made 15 copies. And who wanted the sources? There were two copies you wanted. Okay, two copies, everything copied. That's Rabbi Lookstein's letter to Dr. Belkin about graduation at Yeshiva College 1946. It's a Meredith letter that captures the Yeshiva, orthodoxy, what it looked like, Rabbi Lookstein and Dr. Belkin. If you have any feeling for... listen, you tell me when you graduated college. Tell me what it was like. Thank you.